From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you watch your share of local television news, it might be hard to believe the premise of Steven Pinker's latest book. Despite the live shots at courthouses and the B-roll of police tape, violence in the world is declining. Whether you're looking at domestic violence, at crime statistics, at genocides, even the treatment of animals and the spanking of children. In fact, Pinker says if you look over the long course of human life, it's quite possible we're living in the most peaceful time in our history. Today in the program, Steven Pinker is joining us to make his case, and he has the statistics and graphs to make it. But this is also about human nature. Part of this is understanding our inner demons, like revenge and ideology, but it's also about empathy and a moral sense, the better angels of our nature. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his latest book, the acclaimed scholar and scientist Steven Pinker makes the case that over the course of time, violence around the globe has declined. Whether you're looking at domestic violence or war deaths or the way we treat children and animals, Pinker says the decline hasn't been smooth, and it certainly doesn't mean there still aren't plenty of cases of terrible violence throughout the world. But he says the trend is right there for anyone to see, and it's headed downward. In his book, Pinker says when you become aware of this decline, the world begins to look different. Today in the program, Steven Pinker is joining us to make his case. This is also a conversation, of course, about human nature. Part of this is about understanding our inner demons, but it's also about our better angels. The book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Steven Pinker has been called by Time magazine one of its 100 most influential people in the world today. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, and he's joining us today from the studio on Harvard's campus. And Steven Pinker, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Wanted to start with the things that got you started thinking about all of this. And I know that one of the sort of motivators was an essay that you wrote some 6 years ago or so, getting at the question, this question, what are you optimistic about? Talk about how that got you started thinking about all of this.
I had written in a number of my previous books on human nature some throwaway comments on how, despite the fact that I believe there is such a thing as human nature, and it includes some nasty bits like the thirst for revenge and for dominance and an ability to turn off empathy, but despite all of those nasty parts of our nature, there's evidence that we can get better and that life, in fact, has gotten better. It was a little-known fact, for example, that rates of homicide have plunged by about a factor of 50 since the Middle Ages. Or that however bad our rates of death in warfare are today, they're actually far less than rates of death in warfare in tribal and hunter-gatherer and hunter-horticulturalist societies. So when I was asked to contribute a little post on edge.org on what are you optimistic about, I repeated these observations, noted that they're consistent with human nature and that that human nature does have the means to reduce violence. Then I got a flood of emails and letters from scholars in fields I was dimly aware of saying, you know, there's much more evidence for historical declines of violence than you even mentioned in your list. Mm. I heard from peace researchers. These are people who kind of – they're really – I think of them more as war nerds, people who try to tally up rates of death in all of the world's ongoing wars. And they plot them over time, and they showed me a curve where fewer people are dying in war today than just about any time in the last couple of hundred years. I heard from historical criminologists who combed through old county and town records of homicides in medieval Europe. And they said it's not just in England, but in every country, rates of violence have gone down. I heard from a colleague of mine in the psychology department at Harvard who said, oh, you know, rates of child abuse have gone down, physical abuse, sexual abuse, spanking. And I thought, gee, there are all of these trends that seem to be pointing in the same direction, and no one seems to know about them, let alone try to explain them. And so that's what gave me the idea for the book.
You write in the book, you know, right off the bat, you say violence has declined, believe it or not, which sort of raises the question, why are we inclined not to believe that? I mean, to think things that are getting, you know, more violent, not less. You say this in the book, that our cognitive faculties predispose us to believe that we live in violent times. Explain that.
One of the best-known findings in cognitive psychology is that humans are not very good intuitive statisticians. Numbers on a page don't impress us. What impresses us are vivid anecdotes. Yeah. If we can think of a gory plane crash, we're afraid to get on a plane, even though the statistics show that plane travel is far safer than car travel, for example. But you don't hear about all the car crashes that take a steady toll in human life day by day, a few car crashes at a time. And so our intuition is out of whack with the reality. And that's certainly true for violence, yeah, because we get our sense of the state of the world from the news. The news, by definition, is stuff that happens. Things get blown up. Someone shoots someone else. If there's some part of the world where for the 37th year in a row there has not been a war, well, that doesn't make headlines. Mm-hmm. If someone dies in their hospital bed of cancer, that doesn't make the headlines in the same way that it would if they were blown up in a movie theater. So going by the events that we experience, where we can see the carnage, it's fresh in our memory, you can think, my God, there's violence everywhere in the world. It's only when you look at statistics that count up all the nonviolence that there is in the world, all the countries that are at peace, all the people who don't die, who aren't murdered, that you realize how little violence there is altogether. Mm. And also, you have no way of knowing what the trends are unless you have those figures from several points in time.
You also point out there's this reluctance by, as you put it, this large swath of our intellectual culture that has a hard time admitting that there could be anything good about modernity and Western society. This is another reason some may be in denial about the fact of this. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, a lot of moralists and intellectuals and pundits and commentators just don't like the idea that things could have been getting better. There are all kinds of moral agendas that hinge on the world going to hell in a handbasket. There's the there's the religious right that believes that as society has become more secular and the church has become less influential, our civilization is falling to pieces. You've got the green movement that romanticizes life in harmony with nature and sees the coming of industrialization as a great leap backward. A lot of people have an agenda of criticizing the present, possibly because it's a way of criticizing their rivals. We don't have rivals. We don't consider people who lived 100 years ago to be our rivals, and so people tend to criticize the present. And there aren't a lot of people who say, well, the developments of the past couple of hundred years have really made us better off. That used to be popular, the march towards civilization and progress, but it's come to be seem as kind of corny and old-fashioned. And I am a little retrograde in saying that I do believe in progress, and I believe that many of the trends of the last couple of hundred years, such as the advancement of science and reason and cosmopolitanism and individualism and science, have been good for humanity.
Mm. You write about how the historical trajectory of violence, you know, of course it affects our lives, but it also affects how we understand our lives. And I wanted you to talk about that some, because you talk about how this is kind of fundamental to our sense of, you know, of meaning and purpose.
Yes. Have we fallen from a golden age? Yeah. And every effort that we make to improve the human condition just makes us worse off? Or has human striving had a good effect? Have the things that we've been trying to do and that we might continue to do in the future make humanity better off? So there are a few questions that are more fundamental than that one. And that's why I believe in a realization that despite the headlines, the world has become less violent is a message worth considering.
You say in the book that it would be natural to see all of this as kind of a moral saga, as a struggle between evil on one hand and justice on the other hand. But you say some of that may be true, I suppose, but you say that's not really your starting point. You say that that's one explanation in some ways, but this is also about how you kind of – the tweaks in commerce or technology that have gone on over time and the kind of environmental things, like historical things that bear on all of this.
Yes, exactly. We tend to think of triumph of the righteousness over evil, the defeat of Hitler, the civil rights movement, the American Revolution, and certainly there have been moments in history where people have waged moralistic campaigns and they have won, and it has made us better off. But there are probably also developments that were not intended to reduce violence, but have had that effect, and the growth of commerce and exchange and trade may be one of them. If you have better roads and better carts, better timekeeping instruments, money that's recognized in a large territory, enforceable contracts, all of the apparatus of trade, well, it starts to become cheaper to buy stuff than to steal it, and other people become more valuable to you alive than dead. And so exchange of reciprocity, trade, commerce has been a force against violence. I mean, just take a couple of silly examples. Why don't we invade Canada to get their valuable supplies of nickel? Well, the answer is obvious. We don't need to. They're happy to sell it to us and we're happy to buy it. Or why? I don't think, despite the rivalry between China and the United States, that it's particularly likely that we'll fight a war with them. They make all our stuff. We owe them too much money. We'd each be harming ourselves if we fell into war. As the world has more and more commerce, trade, exchange, our interests become more coupled and war becomes less appealing. So that's one example. Another one is education, exchange of information, knowledge. As people know more about the world, they're less likely to fall into toxic conspiracy theories. Why did the crops fail? Oh, it's because a witch cast a spell. Let's go round up some witches and torture them to death. Why is there unemployment? Well, it must be the Jews and the Jewish financiers who are controlling the world's economy. As you come to understand the way the world works and you realize not everything that goes wrong is the product of some malevolent person that has to be neutralized, you're less likely to seek scapegoats and to wreak violence against them. So rise of education, reason, science, intellectual exchange also, I think, has had a pacifying effect.
So some of this is about historical forces. Some of this is about technology. But this is also a conversation, as I said earlier, about human nature. What part does that play in the bigger scheme as you're sort of thinking about the effects of all of this?
One contributor is you know your enemy. You know what aspects of human nature cause violence and you seek workarounds. One of them is the thirst for revenge. You're wronged. Someone's got to pay. Now, I think there was an evolutionary function to revenge. There's a reason why we take pleasure in seeing bad people get their comeuppance, or why we get angry when someone insults us. Namely, in a state of anarchy, that's the only way you protect your interests. If you're the kind of guy that's going to lash out if he's insulted or threatened, then you're the kind of guy that other people don't want to mess with, and you're more likely to have your interests defended. Nowadays, we realize that it's probably better to have to outsource revenge to a third party, namely the courts and the police and the judicial system and the rule of law, so that we don't serve as our own judge, jury, and executioner. But knowing that people have this desire for revenge allows us to target one possible source of violence. Another one is dominance, the fact that people, and particularly one of the two genders, is often obsessed with climbing the totem pole, being top dog, alpha male, and that the urge for glory, honor, prestige, preeminence can be another reason that people go out and conquer their neighbors. Then on the positive side, excuse me, what do we have to work with to counter these inner demons? We've got empathy. When other people's lives become more real to you, you might find it a little harder to torture them or kill them. We've got self-control. There are big part of our brain, our frontal lobes, have connections to the rest of the brain that can inhibit and dampen our urges so that we can, you know, count to 10, we can walk away, we can figure out ways of controlling our own behavior. And then there's reason, the intellect, cognition, the ability to think of violence as a problem to be solved. Just as we try to cure disease and control floods, we can say, well, what can we do now that would make war less likely tomorrow or crime less likely, and apply our intellects and human cognition? I consider perhaps the preeminent of our better angels and the one that might even deserve the most credit for the decline of violence.
You also write about the moral sense. It's one of those better angels, which you say sort of sanctifies a set of norms and taboos that give us a sense about how we're supposed to interact with each other as a culture.
Yes, and the story with a moral sense is complicated. I say only half jokingly in the book, the world has far too much morality. If you were to add up all of the violence committed in the cause of righteous ideologies like militant religions, communism, Nazism, all of which were highly moralistic, all of them sought to bring utopia to Earth, and there were just these people standing in the way. And as soon as they were eliminated, we would attain a golden age. And they've been responsible for some of the worst atrocities in human history. But and likewise, even everyday street killers, most of them don't kill just for convenience, like shoot a convenience store clerk so they can rob the cash register and not be identified in court. Most murders are moralistic. Someone thinks they've been wronged. They've been insulted. Someone's flirted with their girlfriend. Their girlfriend has flirted with someone. They've been cheated in a deal. They've been humiliated. And they go out and seek what they consider to be just revenge. So it's actually – so morality, at least in the sense of what people think of as morality, has probably caused more violence than it's prevented. Though, of course, it can be refined and applied to the greater goal of reducing violence overall. But it's a double-edged weapon.
Mm. As we head into a break here, we should also point out, as you do in the book, that it's a mistake to think that this decline in violence means that we're headed towards some sort of utopian age where violence doesn't exist. I guess it seems silly to have to make that point, but that has been some of the criticism of the book. I was thinking Elizabeth Colbert's piece. She said, you know, it's silly to think violence is going to go away. And that's not at all what you're saying in the book.
No, right from the from the second sentence in the book, in fact. No, I believe in human nature. I believe that there'll always be some hothead who loses his temper in a bar. There'll always be some, woman who puts arsenic in her husband's tea somewhere or other. There will be acts of terrorism. There'll be riots. But there can be fewer of them. And that's a really, really good thing. If you can reduce the rate of violence by half and then by half again and then by half after that, even if you don't get it down to zero, that's an awful lot of people who will live and grow up and have their children and see their children grow up who otherwise would have been sent to an early grave.
Steven Pinker is with us. He is a professor of psychology at Harvard University, author of the book The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. The book, what we should mention, has just recently been released in paperback. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the acclaimed scientist and writer Steven Pinker. He's joining us to talk about what he says may be the most important thing that's happened in human history. Pinker's new book makes the case that over the course of time, violence has declined. In fact, he says we may be living in the most peaceable era ever. It's hard to believe if you see a lot of the news coverage, but whether you're looking at domestic violence, at crime statistics, at genocides, war deaths, violence is way down from any other time in history. His book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, and we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Robert is joining us in Madison, Wisconsin. Robert, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I have a general question to address to Dr. Pinker. I think it's really good to hear a summarization of this data and information that helps people have a little bit more realistic and possibly optimistic view of human nature and what life can hold for people. The question I have, though, is that I'd like to hear you talk a bit about probably another key part you sort of touched on, which is really not cognition so much. Here at Wisconsin, we sometimes think about affect and emotions and how emotions are actually quite important and can be worked with and modified probably as much as cognition can. Theo Wilson of your school there has just published something on the victory of social evolution, I believe is the title, talking about how eusociality or the value of social interaction can be increased and help survive. Did you have any comments on that?
The question of emotions.
Yes, certainly, and it is true that some of the world's foremost emotional researchers are at the University of Wisconsin, such as Richard Davidson, and emotion certainly plays a role in this story in both directions, because it is, of course, emotion that is responsible for all of the hot-headed murders that we read about, the guy who finds his wife in bed or gets insulted at a bar or gets into a fight over a parking space. And a lot of violence is triggered by emotion. And a lot of the control of emotion, namely self-control or self-restraint, I think is necessary for violence to be reduced. Emotion can be mobilized in the other direction against violence as when we experience empathy for other people. Their plight moves us. We anticipate how something will affect some other person, some other country when we make a decision. And so emotion can also help reduce violence. By and large, when it comes to when emotion and restraint are pitted against each other, which they shouldn't always be, but in dealing with a question, have we been too? Do we think too much? Do we reason too much? Are we too inhibited, uptight, self-controlled, or should we let it all hang out? Should we express our emotions? Mm-hmm. I'm generally in the favor of inhibition, self-restraint. That an awful lot of violence is impulsive, emotion-driven. A lot of violence reduction consists of either getting people to think twice, think ahead, or to put into place restraints so that our emotions don't carry us away.
Robert, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. I wanted to ask you about, you write in the book how easy it is to forget just how dangerous life used to be. You put it this way, you say cultural memory tends to pacify the past. And, you know, you talk about how, you know, the past is a place where you had a pretty good chance of coming to bodily harm. And I wanted to talk about some of these because, you know, you write about ancient Greece, for example, the violence there, you know, stories of massacres and rape. And you say, you know, these people seem to accept all of this as some sort of inescapable fact of life, like the weather. The Old Testament.
Yes,
talk about that, if you would. That's really interesting.
Sure. Well, the great Homeric sagas, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the backdrop is a world in which it's just taken for granted that you invade other villages and cities to rape and abduct their women into sexual slavery and massacre all the men. That's just kind of what you do. That's the way life is lived. The Old Testament has one genocide after another, many of them commanded by God. Go out and kill every last man, woman, and child. Occasionally, God says, if you see a really cute woman, then you can keep her, lock her up for a month until she's finished crying her eyes out, and then go in and rape her. We look at the people who say that the Bible is the source of our moral values have not read the Bible, at least not carefully enough. You look at the lives of the saints, you know, St. Catherine and St. George, and you look at the way they met their ends. They were tortured to death, often with in luridly described sexual torture, female saints who had their breasts cut off and spikes hammered into them. You look at Grimm's fairy tales. Mm. The Disney versions have the gruesome parts excised, but you know, birds peck out the eyes of Cinderella's evil stepsisters. Snow White's evil stepmother has to put on red hot shoes and dance until she drops dead. Punch and Judy is just much more violence than a typical video game. We tend to forget these things.
Why do you think we tend to forget them? I mean, because that seems to be the crucial question. Why do we romanticize the past, do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question, partly because our own values have changed and we're not really willing to cut off our history, so we retain the symbols. But actually what happened would be too upsetting given our modern sensibilities, so we repress or censor the ugly parts. Part of it is because people people kind of like violence as entertainment. They're titillated by it. They get derive moral meanings out of it. We have a mind that is fascinated by violence. And even as we become more peaceful in our actual behavior, we haven't lost our thirst for consuming simulated violence and drawing meaning from it. Another example is, by the way, is the cross. I mean, I'm always appalled when I see, you know, a woman wearing a cross around her neck. This is an instrument of the most gruesome, sadistic, unthinkably atrocious torture you could imagine. And it's a symbol, probably the most common symbol in the world. It's another example of how we don't really think about the fact that the brutality of life in which crucifixion was a pretty common form of punishment. Mm. It wasn't reserved for Jesus.
We say that the irony, of course, the early Christians extolled torture as just desserts for the sinful. A lot of ironies in that past.
There are many ironies as you look through history and you see how unexceptionable violence used to be. It just was the way that you lived your life.
Let's go back to the phones. Ross is joining us in Murray, Utah. Ross, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Doug. Thank you, Professor. I wondered what possibly is more of a contributing factor now when we look at our prisons with alcohol and drugs, etc. And then looking at maybe prophecy and religion and the holy wars, etc., the times that we're entering now. I wonder if you could maybe just touch on those two areas. Thank you kindly. Bless you.
Thank you. Well, alcohol certainly is a contributor to violence. People who get drunk lose their inhibitions. And it's not that alcohol makes people violent, but rather people who are more violent by nature and who inhibit it will lose their inhibitions if they are drunk. On the other hand, prohibition, an era in which the rate of violence skyrocketed, also tells us that if you prohibit some commodity that people really want, then an underground economy will grow up beyond the reach of the law. And whenever you have a contraband economy, you have very high rates of violence. And I think my explanation is the dispute resolution apparatus of a modern state, the courts, the police, the judicial system, are a really good way to reduce violence. And if in your line of work you can't use them, you've been cheated in a business deal, you can't file a lawsuit, someone threatens you, you can't dial 911 because the activity you're in is illegal, then you've got to defend your interests with the threat of violence. And that's why America during Prohibition and the parts of the world today that where there's an active trade in cocaine or marijuana or diamonds or strategic minerals that are beyond the reach of the state, you often have high rates of violence. In terms of the future, I certainly don't believe in prophecy. I don't believe that we're going to enter into some holy war. In fact, most of the signs of impending warfare are positive, namely there have been fewer wars. There still are wars. They've killed fewer people than they used to. And the overall predictors of war, such as trade barriers, such as tyrannies, autocratic governments, tend to be trending in a good direction rather than a bad direction. Mm.
You write about ideology as being one of those inner demons, this shared belief system that at times justifies, you know, unlimited violence in the pursuit of unlimited good. And you write about in the book that the main cause of violence in the 20th century was ideology. And one of those was the prospect, I guess, of some coming utopia. Does religion play into that idea of ideology?
Well, in the 20th century, the destructive utopian ideologies were not religious.
Right.
They were communism and Nazism and nationalism. Those would be the three, sometimes overlapping. In earlier centuries, they were religious, such as the Crusades and the European wars of religion, like the Thirty Years' War, which were proportionally almost as destructive as the 20th century genocide, sometimes more destructive. So I think there is a common denominator. It doesn't have to be religion, but it can be. Namely, if you believe that we can bring to earth some heavenly kingdom, some utopia, the thousand-year Reich, the communist utopia, and the only thing standing in the way are some inconvenient people, either people who hear about your scheme for a perfect world and oppose it, or your scheme might say that all the world's troubles are caused by a certain class of people, the bourgeoisie, the infidels, the Jews. Then, since you believe that a perfect world can be attained if only we get rid of these nuisance people, you've got a moral license to kill massive numbers of people, because if you're bringing to Earth a world that will be infinitely good forever, well, you're always ahead of the game. You know, you do the math. It's you're still better off. And so that's why utopian ideologies paradoxically can lead to massive amounts of killing.
Ross, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join us. Back to the phones. John is with us in Salt Lake. John, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, since this curve towards, I guess, safety is general, but has lots of peaks and dips in it, would some of the correlation with the peaks be due to critical population levels, say, related to the environment, how they, you know, run out of food or whatever? Would the fact that we're in a worldwide getting close to a population level be a sign that we might be heading toward another peak?
I suspect not. It is a question that I'm asked quite often. In general, increasing population is not a cause of violence. People can live perfectly well in highly crowded environments. One of the safest places on Earth is Hong Kong, Tokyo, Amsterdam. Many high-density cities are very safe. And the world just keeps getting more and more populous, but we have fewer wars and deaths now than we had in at times when the world had far fewer people. In general, it's surprising how few wars are actually fought over tangible resources, that is, over the last bit of food or water. Among other things, you can divide resources. What you can't divide are glory, righting historical wrongs, grievances, utopian schemes. Those are causes for which you may not compromise, whereas you can always divide the water supply in half. And studies that try to correlate environmental stress at time one with war at time two tend to find little or no correlation. Now, this isn't a reason to be complacent about environmental pressure and climate change. I mean, they can cause an awful lot of misery and waste even if they don't lead to war. But it suggests that it's the wrong place to look for rises and falls in organized violence.
John, thanks very much. Back to the phones. Dave is with us in Salt Lake. Dave, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I was talking to my son, a very clever son, but I suppose all people believe their sons are clever, and bemoaning Fox News and its outlook on life. And he laughed at me and said, "Father, you're a fool. Fox News is simply a commercial enterprise that takes a worldview that they can sell. and in the context of violence and the sort of let's say Republican Manichaeism that we see, do you see a means? First off, do you agree with that analysis? And second, do you see a means by which one can take a more Taoist view, with all due respect to John Stewart, and deal with the right versus wrong Manichaeism and come up with a balance of opposing forces kind of morality that becomes sufficiently popular as to be dominant?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't know whether I suspect that the people at Fox News are partly motivated by what sells, but I suspect a lot of them believe it, that people certainly have very strong political convictions. And it's a really important question of how we can move beyond mutual demonization and try to analyze issues in their own right instead of just, well, what should I say as a right winger, what should I say as a left winger, but rather what's the problem and how do we solve it? In general, I tend to think that diversity of viewpoints, free speech, multiple channels of communication are a good thing. But we might even have to be a bit smarter than just opening up channels of communication and presenting both sides of an argument in order to have a more intelligent discourse. My colleague Cass Sunstein, who recently was part of the Obama administration, wrote an interesting article the week before last on what gets people to change their mind. And surprisingly and kind of depressingly, presenting both sides of an argument does not, nor does engaging people in discussion, because you engage people in discussion with people who disagree with them, and they often get even more extreme because they think, well, I presented all these overwhelming arguments to the other guy and he still didn't believe me. That just shows that doesn't listen, he's impervious to reason, and both sides think that. Mm-hmm. Or when you see the side-by-side editorials like you see in USA Today, pro and con, what you do is you read the pro and you nod your head, all the more reason to believe what I believe. You read the con and you dismiss everything point by point, and you often end up more extreme than when you began. But there is a bright point, and Sunstein notes that what is highly effective is if someone that you trust, someone on your side, changes his mind. Then you think, gee, I can't blow him off. He's in my coalition. He's on my team. Maybe I better give a listen. And therefore, directing your arguments against the most reasonable people who are associated with the other side might tactically be the best way to change people's minds.
Mm. Dave, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST again, the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Professor Steven Pinker is with us. His book is The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It's just now out in paperback, we should mention. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Professor Steven Pinker is with us. His book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. In the book, you work through the questions of where this violence comes from, the questions of aggression in primates, our primate ancestors. And the question comes up, is there or was there an evolutionary advantage to being violent? Talk about that.
Yes, not to being indiscriminately violent, right. Because if you just pick fights with someone, with people at random, they may be bigger and stronger than you and you might be ground into the dirt or worse. So we don't have a violent impulse in the sense of in the way that we get hungry, yeah, or have sexual desire where we've got a kind of a hydraulic urge that has to be satisfied every once in a while. We just have to burst out in violence. And it's a common misconception, one that I always have to deal with. Like if you have if you reduce violence, isn't the urge going to just build up and explode? And the answer is no. That's just not the way violent instincts work. They're triggered by particular situations. It's more like shivering or sneezing than like hunger or thirst. That is, you could, if you never get cold again, you could go the rest of your life without shivering. Mm. And in some circumstances, even though I believe that we all have violent impulses, we may never be in a situation in which we have to express them. Sometimes violence emerges from revenge. You get insulted and you feel your only recourse is to punish them. Sometimes it's to climb a dominance hierarchy and become alpha male. Sometimes there are some people who are sadists who actually take pleasure out of other people's suffering. And then there's just old-fashioned exploitation. That is, someone is just an obstacle towards what you want and you eliminate them to get at something. Many of those could be biologically adaptive. We know even from studies of tribal peoples that often it's the man who's killed the most who has the most wives and the most offspring. And you don't have to do a whole lot of math to figure that in a world like that, Darwinian natural selection would favor any genes that inclined you to violence when you could get away with it, if the violence consisted of besting other men and having more women toward yourself, if you're a man.
I wanted to ask you about the civilizing process. It's the name of a chapter. And you write about, I guess we could put it this way, you had a kind of an epiphany about table manners.
Yes.
Talk about that, because that I think that's instructive here.
Yes, because the civilizing, it all sounds very quaint and Victorian, especially since the 1960s, which moved so radically in the opposite direction. There's a wonderful book by a German sociologist named Norbert Elias, who argued that in the transition from the Middle Ages to modern times, people became civilized in many ways at once. The one that I'm most interested in is they were less likely to stab each other over the dinner table over minor insults. But Elias points out that part of the progress towards modernity consisted of many forms of self-control. People had sex in private rather than in the view of others. They became more ashamed of sexual matters. Words for sexual organs and activities became taboo. They became our swear words. It used to be that our swear words were religious. Now they're more sexual. People developed table manners. They would not kind of fall on the food as soon as it was served and grab a chunk of meat and with their hands and chew on it and put the bone back in the serving dish and spit out the little bits onto the tablecloth or onto their laps. They wouldn't wipe their nose with the tablecloth. All these things that we teach three-year-olds had to be acquired in the course of European manners. And Elias argued that this was all of a piece, that if your culture exercises your faculty of self-control, if the general way to get ahead is to control your impulses, then you will have less violence as people become less likely to respond to provocations. Mm. You go from a culture of honor, where it's a matter of honor to respond to an insult with violence, to a culture of dignity, where a respectable person is the one who can walk away and control his or her impulses.
So you write about the fact that when authority comes into place, when there's a rule of law and police, for example, or some sort of law enforcement, when there are social rules, this sort of brings some of these impulses under control. I wondered about other cultural aspects like literature and art. What influence do you think that's had on our impulses toward violence or away from violence?
There is a school of thought that I'm sympathetic to, that when you expose people to the inner lives of other people through biography and journalism and even fiction where the characters don't even exist, you expand people's sense of empathy and people are more likely to get into the habit of thinking, what is it like to be that person? him or her, even if they're not like me, even if I'm a man and she's a woman or vice versa, even if I'm European and he or she is Chinese or African, you feel their pain through losing yourself in fiction. And there's some evidence that when you expose people to first-person accounts of someone else's life, they're more sympathetic to that person and to the entire category of people that that individual represents. The original impetus for this idea was the fact that prior to the humanitarian reforms of the Enlightenment, the banning of grisly torture executions like burning at the stake or breaking on the wheel, as in the American Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, the abolition of blood sports like bear baiting and dog fighting, the elimination of debtors' prisons, the rise of democracy, all of these humanizing movements occurred in an era in which more and more people were literate. Books and literature became cheap and mass market. Millions of people started reading novels. Maybe it's not a coincidence. Maybe all of that reading, including the reading of novels, made people more cognizant of the pleasures and pains of other people. And so bringing out the kids to watch someone get tortured to death no longer seemed as fun as it used to be.
You make a distinction in the book between in early human history, you make a distinction between those tribes who lived in more settled communities with, you know, some kinds of governance and rules, and those that just kind of wandered around foraging. And it made me wonder what you think all of this has to do with also the development of language. How has language played into the question of violence, do you think?
Yeah, we don't really know, because it's the language leaves no trace in the fossil or archaeological record. But we have reason to believe that for as long as we've been our species, anatomically modern Homo sapiens, we've had language, partly because every human society today has language, and so language probably emerged at least 60,000 years ago when the current human populations diverged. And the fact that it developed so readily and spontaneously in children. So language has been around for a long time. It can encourage violence as you spread conspiracy theories or mobilize allies in a raiding party. It can also diffuse violence as you enter into negotiations on how you can split the difference or mutually agree not to bash each other.
Let's take another call. Paul is with us in Moab, Utah. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm listening to the show. I enjoy it.
Thank you.
My question was, you mentioned that people use symbology such as a crucifix to pronounce their faith, and you mentioned that it also symbolizes all the potential damage that that faith has done to society and to people that are not of the faith, or even people that are in the faith as well. How do you perceive that those people can have a cognizant mindset but still validate the fact that they, what they represent or that represents is an impact negatively on humankind?
That's a big question.
Yes. First of all, we need honest history. We have to know about atrocities not just in the present but in the past. So we really need to know about the wars of religion and religious persecution, such as following the Reformation. I think, also have to know about changes for the better. It can't just be history is one bloody mess and always has been, and there's nothing you can do about it. But look at some of the things that have worked. The fact that even though the United Nations is a lot of what goes on there is, you know, is and should be a laughingstock, but the United Nations has done some things right. UN peacekeeping forces, for example, have reduced the risk of warfare when you do the studies. The whole concept behind the UN, namely that if you're a member of the UN, you have a guaranteed right to exist, and no United Nations state may claim territory from any other one. That seems like an obvious idea, but it's a new idea in human history. It used to be kind of a commonplace that if you coveted your neighbor's land and you could get away with it, then it's perfectly fine to conquer it. That practice was pretty much put to an end by the establishment of the UN, with a few exceptions here and there. The idea that democracy has reduced the likelihood of war, that trade has reduced the likelihood of war, that international organizations, not just the UN but the European Union and NATO and other clubs that various nations belong to, make them less likely to go to war with each other. All of the positive lessons, I think, could help neutralize toxic ideologies. And the idea that we're all humans, that the divisions into races and nations are pretty shallow, that other people are in large part like us, they feel the same pains and take the same pleasures, makes it harder to develop ideologies that demonize entire classes of people.
Mm. You know, in the book you say that when you become aware of the decline of violence, the world begins to look different, as you put it, the past seems less innocent. The present seems less sinister. Do you think knowing this history can change the way we think of ourselves as a species, and you know, the cultures and institutions we create?
I think so. Yes, I hope so, and I believe that that's what has been happening. If you think that putting our heads together and figuring out ways to reduce the likelihood of war have worked in the past and can work in the future, maybe you'll think harder and work harder to implement them. And there's also just as a human being living a meaningful life, looking around you and seeing what humans have accomplished. Namely, we do manage to live together in peace better than we did in the past, not perfectly. But human ingenuity, human effort, human mobilization have made a difference, and in many ways we're extraordinarily fortunate. That just changes your, I think, appreciation for being alive in this era, and it gives you more respect for the times that we live in, problematic though they are.
Steven Pinker is a professor of psychology at Harvard University. His book is The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. He joined us from a studio at Harvard. And Professor, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.